Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we take a look at 100 songs recorded right here in Arizona.
And why one investigative reporter says the grisly realities of a criminal mind are important to reckon with.
But first, local Republican Party Chair Lisa Everett was censured by her own party this month for advocating for a local restaurant owner and mother who is being held in ICE detention pending deportation. She told Phoenix New Times while she's all for getting the worst of the worst, she doesn't support separating good people from their family. Kelly Yu is the owner of Kauai Sushi and Asian Cuisine in the West Valley. She's a mother and she's been in the U.S. for more than 20 years. But now she's being held at Eloy Detention Center after being detained during a routine immigration check-in in May. She could be deported to Hong Kong soon. She came here fleeing China's one-child policy 20 years ago when she was pregnant with a baby girl, according to the Arizona Republic. She has no criminal record. Her story and the local reaction to it is a reflection of what our next guest calls the myth of the ideal immigrant, someone worth celebrating and keeping in our community, unlike so many other immigrants who are denigrated. Perla Guerrero directs the U.S. Latino Studies Program at the University of Maryland. I spoke with her more about the myth of the ideal immigrant and who's hurt in the process.
I mean, I think it's a sort of normal reaction when a community finds out that someone that they actually like, love, or care for is one of the people that the administration is trying to remove. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the vexed position of immigrants in the United States, especially if they are undocumented or entered without authorization, that people make lives, they make community, they build bonds, and the U.S. government can come in and say, you're not wanted here anymore. And the irony is that the local community might actually want that specific person. Right. That's the tension.
Right.
You know, they're not willing to give up someone like Kelly Yu, but they are willing to give up unnamed folks.
It is manifesting itself here right now as this sort of bipartisan moment often where you're seeing people from opposite sides of the aisle sort of say, oh, yes, we disagree on mass deportations in general, but we agree on this one person. Because there's also this narrative that the Trump administration had promised to deport criminals, right? But there seems to me, Perla, like a very vast gap between criminals and these kind of model ideal immigrants.
Right. I mean, I think that's another tension. The idea of who is a criminal or what is a criminal act, I think, is something that is also unexplored. So in many states, it is now legal to consume small quantities of marijuana. So having marijuana is no longer a criminal act or a criminal offense. Mm-hmm. And yet there are still people who are in jail for having had a quantity of marijuana. So I think in some ways, the local issue is in some ways disjointed from the national issue, right? Mm-hmm. National policy can say we're going after criminals, but what does that actually mean? And when was a supposed criminal act committed is sort of what makes this quite messy.
How far back in U.S. history does this kind of myth of an ideal or a good immigrant go?
It has very long roots, at least to the 1920s, when there was much more discretion to say, well, a person has established ties with the local community, an immigrant has a family in the U.S., they have children, and so we're going to use our discretionary power to say that this is a good immigrant, mm-hmm. and we're gonna cancel their deportation. Historically, though, the idea of who's a good immigrant deserving of relief is rooted in also ideas around race. For a long time, Asian immigrants were excluded from the narrative of being a good immigrant. There was a bar against Chinese immigrants. Mm-hmm. Mexican people were also often excluded. it was in the 1920s and 30s, it was largely Europeans and Canadians who benefited the most from discretionary powers. That said, you're a good immigrant and the U.S. wants you here. In the 100 years since then, the idea of good immigrant, bad immigrant has morphed. It can include Latinos now, but it also is, it's an idea that's very sensitive to the political moment and to economic strife. So anytime that there's a bit of a downturn in the U.S. economy, most immigrants get the brunt of like, well, immigrants are taking American jobs.
Right.
And so then the idea of a good immigrant doesn't go as far as it does when it's a prosperous time and there's plenty of jobs and immigrants do, you know, do the work in fields that require that labor power.
Yeah. What does assimilation have to do with this as well? And certain populations of immigrants being held up as sort of being better at assimilating into American culture than others.
Yeah. The idea of assimilation is also quite powerful in immigration law. The idea that historically, Asian immigrants were excluded from that idea. They were actually considered to be unassimilable, that they could not learn English, that their ideas around even government and democracy were too different from their countries of origin. And so assimilation is also one of those tools that the U.S. government has used to decide whether you have done enough as an immigrant to incorporate into the United States. But that gets tricky because it's a very amorphous idea. If an immigrant speaks English, if an immigrant votes in local and national elections, as we have seen, that is not enough for Latinos to be exempt from being stopped in the street and questioned about their citizenship status because they were heard speaking Spanish, or because they're working a low-wage job, which the government assumes is only done by people without documentation.
Mm-hmm.
So assimilation is never really as clear of an idea as we think it is. And there's always ideas about race that underpin whether we think someone has assimilated enough into the United States.
Who's harmed in this kind of idea? It seems like kind of harmless, right? Like saying, mm-hmm. well, this person is really great and an example of what an immigrant could be or should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone is hurt, to be quite honest. No matter what you do, no matter how much English you learn, how well you speak it, maybe how much education you have, you can always be questioned. Are you really a U.S. citizen? Do you really belong in the nation? Do we want people like you here? Right? I think it creates a lot of suspicion of our friends and our neighbors and our peers in school. And I think it's not a good way to navigate immigration in a country that has had it for such a long time.
Let me ask you lastly, Perla, I know you're currently writing a book on deportation and this idea that, you know, someone might get deported and then has to return to life in the old country, in their home country, maybe often mm-hmm. without knowing it very well. There's certainly yes. a lot of that going on right now. I wonder, like, what common threads you're finding for folks who go through this?
Yeah, so I'm writing specifically about Mexicans who end up back in Mexico. And one of the greatest things that they experience is alienation, especially young people, right? If you entered the United States as a child, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, although Spanish was your first language, you probably don't speak it very well. But in the case of young people, often they don't speak Spanish at all. They're not familiar with Mexican cultural norms in Mexico. Gender norms and labor practices are quite foreign to them. So they go through a long process of feeling out of place in a country that they're told is their home when it is not their home. Their home is the United States. They just didn't have the legal status that allowed them to remain.
That's interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Perla Guerrero joining us, an associate professor of American Studies and director of the U.S. Latino Studies Program at the University of Maryland. Perla, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Lauren.
Ricky Wassenaar has been confounding law enforcement and journalists for decades. Most recently, Wassenaar claims to have killed several fellow inmates in a Tucson prison. He was already in the midst of serving 16 consecutive life sentences for various crimes, including armed robbery and sexual assault. Not long before the murders he claims to have committed, Wassenaar had been moved out of maximum security. The deaths were one of several recent incidents that prompted a legislative inquiry into detention policies at the Department of Corrections. Michael Kiefer, a longtime investigative journalist here in Arizona, has been covering Wassenaar since the early 2000s. After Kiefer published a lengthy profile of Wassenaar earlier this year, we spoke about why he considers Wassenaar such a compelling subject.
In 2004, Ricky Wassenaar and another prisoner took over the Lewis prison down in Buckeye. For 15 days, they were holed up. They were trying to escape, but they wound up trapped in a tower. A year later, it went to trial. So I covered that trial, and I interviewed Wassenaar. And in ways, it was very entertaining. He defended himself, and you know, it was a very dramatic trial with him cross-examining his own victims. And I think we all had a little bit of the journalists covering it. We all had a bit of Stockholm syndrome. Not that we supported what he had done, but he was charismatic and at times funny.
Talk a little bit about the things that stayed with you.
Yes, yes. So at one point, I requested an interview with him in the jail. Now, it's not unusual over 40 some years of being a reporter that people charged with very serious things are trying to convince you that they're the nicest person in the world, you know. But he worried about the fact that it was my wife's birthday. And indeed, you know, here you are talking to me when you should be home with your wife. And so, you know, and yet he had held hostages. He had beaten the male correctional officer, Jason Elk, and he had allegedly sexually assaulted the female correctional officer, Lois Fraley. And I have to say this, that I think Ricky Wassenaar is a lot of things. You know, he's violent. He's a criminal. He's, you know, assaulted people. Now he's killed people. But I don't think he's a liar. And I bring that up because it plays into what he did in April of this year.
Let's talk about what he did, because the violence of it is brutal and his avowed morality behind it is just as stark.
And again, when you get into this sort of, you know, prison code of honor, you know, sex offenders are at the lowest rings of the prison hierarchy. Child sex offenders are the lowest of the low. And now here's Ricky Wassenaar, who denies that he's a sex offender, housed on a sex offender unit. He told them, if they put someone else in my cell, I will kill them. Right. Well, that happened sometime early in April, and they put in a man named Saul Alvarez in 2016 or something, had kidnapped, raped, and killed a 15-year-old girl in Maricopa County. And Wassenaar allegedly, and now this has not been confirmed by either the Pima County Attorney's Office or by the prison, but the word out is that Wassenaar suffocated him with some sort of plastic and then made it look as if he was asleep in the cell. Then he went out onto the yard, and he had a stone that he had, like fishnet laundry bag, that he put the stone in. The prisoners were starting to line up for breakfast. And to get into the mess hall, they have to go through what they call the cage. It's sort of like a chain link tunnel. And he went in and started swinging that rock and killed two more people. And among the things that were really sort of, you know, telling was that he said that, you know, let me get the exact quote, the taxpayers no longer have to pay for them.
Right.
I'm paying my debt to society. So,
right. Well, this gets to what is so confounding about Wassenaar as a subject in my mind. And I'm curious to get your take on this. Is clearly he's expressing to you that he had the explicit intention of killing these people. one of the things you point out in the piece is that, and that you've been talking about today, is that Wassenaar charmed a lot of people. And I'm curious, what has it been like for you to try to navigate that when you cover somebody like him? How do you navigate moments where you worry he might be trying to charm you?
It's not that he's trying to, it's not that he's trying to charm me. I mean, he was pretty, you know, straight out, you know, angry and offensive. It's something else that you realize after, and I've written this and I've said this many times, that the scariest thing about murderers is that sometimes they aren't scary. Many times they aren't scary. And, you know, as my friend Dale Bache will say, you know, who is a longtime federal public defender, you know, you still find a humanity, you know, in these people. And sometimes, you know, the scariest part is that you will talk to someone and there are so many parts of them that seem normal. And you know that there are some very bad circuits.
Yeah.
You talk about, you know, Ricky Wassenaar's thought that he's ridding the world of child molesters. It's like, well, you just can't do that. There are all these different personality facets that you start to see, so that it doesn't really surprise me.
Mm-hmm. But there seems to be, if I'm not mistaken, some importance in your mind of presenting somebody like this in their full humanity, even in spite of the fact that he, you know, he's now confessing to these incredibly brutal murders, that there is some import to that.
Yeah, there is. And that's why they talk to me, you know, because, you know, I will listen. You know, I mean, it's, you know, another thing that was said to me once, I think it was a police officer who said, you know, to answer the question, why would people do this? Things like this. And the answer is, you know, you'd have to be like them to understand it. You know, it's not explainable.
So would you say that's part of the goal here, is like not to explain it, but to answer that question by saying like, well, here is the person who is like this.
Right. And we're not going to pretend it's not horrible.
It strikes me as we're talking about this that, you know, that question that gets asked in situations like this, how could somebody do this, assumes that there is a well-calibrated mind making these calculations. And if I'm hearing you right, you're saying the counter to that is not that there is a logic to it that any of us would understand. It's that there is a logic in the mind of somebody like Ricky Wassenaar, and that there is some value to having his logic, as broken as it may be, laid bare so that we can realize how little sense it makes.
I think that's exactly it. It's beyond the pale, but this is what he thinks he's doing.
Well, Michael Kiefer is a longtime reporter around Phoenix and the state, most recently a writer for AZ Mirror. Michael, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, from alt-rock to blues, the top 100 songs recorded in Arizona.
People were just, have always been making super interesting, super creative, super cool music that each of them had a backstory. And so I was really impressed by just the diversity throughout the whole state. It's by no means just a Phoenix list.
We'll hear a breakdown of the few of the most notable songs on the list and the stories behind them. But first, if you've ever watched a movie that looks like it's shot here in Arizona, odds are it was actually filmed in New Mexico. That's even true for the movie Arizona and 310 to Yuma. That's because New Mexico offers filmmakers generous subsidies to film there, and it has spurred a major film production industry in that state. So lawmakers here attempted to create something similar a few years ago, offering up $125 million to film companies in refundable tax credits to make movies here in Arizona. But the libertarian think tank, the Goldwater Institute, sued over it, and they got their day in court last week. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez is covering it all, and she joins us now to explain. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, what is Goldwater arguing here?
Well, they're upset because they don't like, basically, they don't like any spending of taxpayer dollars on stuff that they don't approve of. And in this case, they're saying that taxpayer dollars are going to something that doesn't actually benefit the taxpayers. And they're arguing that it's a violation of Arizona's constitutional gift clause.
Hmm. Okay. So how exactly would this program work, or is it working? The state is offering $125 million refundable tax credits. What does that mean?
It means you come here and you make your movie, and then whatever like costs you too much money, you know, more than your production cost, you tell the state, hey, we need a tax credit basically to refund for that amount. And then you get cut a check for however much that is. And it's up to $125 million as of this year, because it was implemented back in 2023, but it was much lower at the time.
Right. It's been sort of scaled up. Mm-hmm. Why did lawmakers want to create this kind of program? It was a bipartisan effort, right?
It was a bipartisan effort. Largely, Democrats were happy about it. Republicans were very mixed on it, and Ducey allowed it to go into law without signing it, which is, you know, basically just a ceremonial thing. But it means the governor didn't physically sign the bill. I think, you know, this is something that's been attempted for a really long time, back into the 90s. And we actually had a film tax credit program for a while in 2005 to, I think, 2015. But it wasn't working, so they got rid of it. They let it die. And in this case, one of the opponents actually is the current Senate president, Warren Peterson. He didn't like it at the time. He doesn't like it now. And he's and the Goldwater Institute, of course, making the same argument, which is that it's just not working for us at all.
What does that mean, it's not working? Like, it's not bringing film companies here?
Yeah, the idea is that film companies were going to come here and it was going to be super great, and they were going to spend all of this money in Arizona, and they were going to pay all the stuff in like sales tax, and it was going to be super great for our economy, and then all the movies would be made here, and we would really stick it to New Mexico, and they would be so sad, and we would be so great. But that hasn't really happened yet. I mean, you know, you never know. I guess it could happen in the future, but they're saying that it's never going to happen.
Okay. Okay. So, right. The lawyer for Goldwater who argued this case said there's no proven value here. What does this look like, though, in New Mexico? I mean, it seems to have worked there. Is it a very different program?
I don't think it's a very different program. They've had it for a while. I believe theirs is percentage based. And I think that Texas also has a small amount or decent amount of Westerns filmed there, but it's been somewhat easy for Hollywood to just bypass Arizona, literally fly over and go to New Mexico to do that. And it's been successful, and that's sort of established there now.
Right.
I think here we don't have as much established in the first place, so we really need to get some momentum to get off the ground with this movie industry that we don't really have.
Yeah, yeah. The lawyer defending the state here says that tax credits are not gifts, because this is, of course, about the gift clause. If the judge ruled for Goldwater here and against this tax incentive, that would set a pretty important precedent, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be saying that all tax credits are in violation of the Arizona Constitution, but it would be saying, you know, it would kind of be, I think, maybe the death knell for this idea, at least for the foreseeable future, because they've tried and tried again. And, you know, in this case, if it's not working, it's not working. They apparently have a professor who's going to come in and tell them that they have a fiscal impact analysis and it's not working.
Hmm. Okay. This program would be carried out by the Arizona Commerce Authority, right? Mm-hmm. That's also been under scrutiny of late for holding these, you know, so-called CEO forums. And all of that controversy also had to do with the gift clause, right?
It did. And there was sort of the accusation of whining and dining, you know, folks with taxpayer dollars. And does that really benefit us? Or is it just abusing basically taxpayer money to try to get something? And, you know, the Commerce Authority has been under scrutiny for a variety of reasons for many years. But I think there are a fair amount of Republicans in particular who feel that way, who feel that it's negatively using taxpayer dollars.
OK, so this is really interesting because it sounds like this debate will continue, Cameron, right? Like there are major disagreements here about how the state can boost industry and how involved it should be in creating industry or being involved in business. Right. This is, sounds like a very different GOP.
Yeah, I mean, the Goldwater Institute has a conservative take on things, of course. And I was talking to one of their attorneys after the oral argument, and he was basically saying that it shouldn't be bureaucrats who decide what happens with taxpayer dollars. Taxpayer dollars should stay with the taxpayer as much as possible. But if they have to be spent, the taxpayer should have as much say as possible in how they're being spent, and they should have the maximum benefit to the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And there should be accountability for that.
Okay. What's the timeline look like here, Cameron? What are we watching for next year?
Well, we're watching for the judge to make a decision. There's two requests in front of the judge right now. One of them is to dismiss the case completely. That's, of course, you know, the state asking for that. And then the other request is from the Goldwater Institute. They want an injunction now.
Okay. We will see what happens then. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk, as she does. Cameron, thanks for this one. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. We're coming to the end of beach read season, and with everything going on in the world, who can blame you if you spent your summer immersing yourself in lighter fare? Well, as the calendar flips to autumn, the show's resident book expert, Mark Athatakis, is here with a preview of some of the most intriguing books coming out this fall, and they've all got a lot to say about some pretty serious subjects. But that doesn't mean they're not page-turners. We started with a book that's actually already available on bookstore shelves, Peter Orner's novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. As Mark explained, it's inspired by the tragic story of real-life columnist Irv Kupcinet.
He was the Luella Parsons or Walter Winchell of Chicago back in the 50s and 60s. He was the gossip columnist. So if Frank Sinatra was dining at some swanky downtown hotel, he was the person who was going to report in the Chicago Sun-Times about it. Now, this story turns on a darker story that involves his daughter, Karen, who was a young actress on TV and film. And in 1966, she was found dead, likely murdered, in her apartment in Los Angeles. And this novel is the attempt to untangle the murder and deals with the narrator's obsession with the Kupcinet family, his own family's relationship with it. So it deals with a lot of complicated feelings that happen with fame, celebrity, darkness, murder.
I also am really intrigued by the idea of fictionalizing the experience of being obsessed with a drama in someone else's family.
Yes, because the narrator is dealing with his own family relationships in the same way. So in some ways, the trauma that the Kupcinet family was experiencing becomes a kind of mirror for the trauma that his own family was experiencing, because this event has a blast radius.
Well, let's move to the next one. This is by Dan Shaun, and it's another novel. It's called One of Us.
Yes. So Dan Shaun is very talented at splitting the middle between literary fiction and horror fiction. And this novel, the phrase may resonate in the back of some people's minds because it comes from the 1932 horror movie Freaks, which was featured actual sideshow performers, the bearded ladies and so forth. So obviously it's a very un-PC term, but it is about the idea of creating community in unusual ways. And so this story turns on a pair of twins who have certain psychic powers and have literally run away to join the circus. So it uses Todd Browning's film Freaks as kind of a launch pad for talking about how do you create community among misfits. It's meant to discomfort the reader, but it also has a remarkable amount of heart for a story that has this kind of premise.
And am I right that there's a bit of an inversion there in intention as compared to Todd Browning's film, right? Because I remember being shown by a film nerd friend when I was far too young, Todd Browning's film, Freaks. Mm-hmm. In my memory, at least, a big part of that experience was that it felt like the film was kind of intentionally othering its subjects.
Yeah, it never quite reconciles the idea of making its characters on the screen ripe for exploitation, but also underneath it is this theme of one of us, one of us. Uh-huh. People who are Ramones fans may remember that they co-opted that phrase, gabba gabba, one of us, to say that, okay, yeah, we're misfits, but we're together. That's not necessarily something that the movie itself does a great job of amplifying, though it's there. And I think that's something that Dan Shaun is trying to play with and trying to elevate a little bit more.
All right. Well, let's talk about one more novel. This one is by Brandon Taylor, and it's called Minor Black Figures.
Yes. So Brandon Taylor is a very accomplished African-American novelist, and this novel is concerned with African-American art. Its main character is a painter who is black and who is gay in New York City, but he is chafing at those sorts of identity characteristics and trying to find a way to live outside of them, and also recognizing that that is a little hard for him to do. And the thing about this novel that I love is that Brandon Taylor has a real knack for getting into the real grit of social relationships and life in the city. The way I've described it to people is that if you liked A Little Life, but it felt a little bit too big and melodramatic and a little bit too much, and for a lot of people it was a lot of too much, this novel has the same kind of sensibility and the same kind of cast of characters, but feels a little bit more manageable. It feels a little bit more earthbound.
And if I'm hearing right, it sounds like letting the details of a life that some readers might be less familiar with be enough in and of themselves.
Indeed. And the novel dwells on this movie called Gene Dealman, which Chantal Ackerman's movie, which if you've seen it, it's a 3.5-hour movie where practically nothing happens.
Until the end.
until the very end. It's just there's about 3 hours and 15 minutes of a woman just going about her errands and managing her apartment and trying to make money however she can. And clearly Brandon Taylor is enchanted with that kind of slowness, that sort of what do you see when you are attuning yourself to paying attention to the close details?
Well, Brandon Taylor, if you're listening, I think Sight and Sound named Gene Dealman the best movie of all time.
Correct.
So not a bad comparison from Mark Athatakis. All right. For our last one, this is a new book by Susan Orlean, and this one is nonfiction. It's a memoir called Joyride.
Yes. So Susan Orlean, and this is a personal thing. I wanted to be Susan Orlean when I grew up. She was
same.
A longtime writer for The New Yorker, and she was extremely gifted at writing pure feature stories, by which I mean delightfully irrelevant subject matters. Her most famous feature story, which she talks about at length in the book, is called The American Man at Age 10, where she just profiled an average, everyday, suburban 10-year-old boy.
I love that one.
The first couple of paragraphs where she imagines what they would be like if they were married is one of the funniest and truest and most poignant pieces of observational writing that I know of. And so she's really just focused on stories that are this looks interesting. It's rare for an alt-weekly writer to maintain this sort of positivity that just runs through the entire book. She is – I mean the title is literally about how much pleasure she has gotten in all the things that she's had to explore during her career.
Well, and I didn't know until going into this conversation that she had a background in alt-weeklies. I only knew of her time at The New Yorker. What was the part of the alt-weekly world that she traveled to?
Her first job was at Willamette Week, which was Portland, Oregon's alt-weekly.
Yes.
And this is talking about in the 70s, which was kind of the heyday of the alt-weekly, where you were given free rein to try new ideas. And it may break the heart of aspiring journalists or younger journalists like me, because she would talk about, I want to expand my career. How do I do that? Well, I just called the San Francisco office of Newsweek and said, can I write features? And they said yes. And so she has really and truly lived a charmed life.
Yeah. Yeah. But obviously had the goods to match that stroke of good fortune.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one thing she certainly gets into in the book is the depth of research that is involved, but also the pleasure that she finds in research. And I think anybody who's spent serious time working on weird, offbeat, all-weekly stories recognizes that part of the joy of it is discovering things about this weird little world that nobody else knows and that you're really excited to report out into the world.
Well, I've been speaking with the show's resident book expert, Mark Athatakis. Mark, thank you as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. When you think of the best recording hubs in the country, Los Angeles probably comes to mind. If you're into country music, then Nashville. Hip-hop? Atlanta. But our next guest is here to argue Arizona has its own rich history of recording music. In fact, so much so that he and a team of panelists compiled a list of the top 100 songs recorded in Arizona for the Daily Independent. Steve Stockbar is the Independent's entertainment editor, and he's been in Arizona for more than 30 years writing about the arts community here. And he told me coming up with this era-spanning list was no easy task.
Came about just from listening to songs, which I do anyway, and I try to find and collect obscure stuff just because it's fun for me in a nerdy way. And I think I can't remember the song that sort of sparked the idea, but it was a gradual thing. All of a sudden, I had like 9 or 10 songs I had never heard before, and I realized that they were recorded here. And I said, well, that's an interesting sort of thing to follow. And started deliberately looking for songs that I did not know. And it just, there were so many. I couldn't believe it. And we had actually started out of it being a top 50 list. We thought that would be a good round number.
Yeah.
We could kind of include different eras, different decades, different genres. And there was so many, I think after about 2 or 3 months, we were well over 60 and still finding stuff. So it became obvious, well, let's be kind of ambitious and maybe we can get 100 out of it. And we did. In fact, there were some that we couldn't use.
Okay, so let's talk about a few that stand out to you. We clearly can't get to all 100 here. But one I wanted to ask you about is number 4 on your list. And it's by the Sun City Girls, right? Tell us about this.
Well, they're just weird. It was really important to us to include every genre and every decade. So rock and roll, great jazz community throughout the years in Phoenix, country, so many genres, hip hop. I don't know if there is a genre for the Sun City Girls except punk, but very unique in that the songs I was familiar with the Sun City Girls even before this, but learning about the backstory about how they recorded it. And I did reach out to one of the brothers from the band, Richard Bishop, who's up in the Pacific Northwest now, and also found an old interview with him from about 10 years ago. And just to hear that they recorded it in the front room of a house across from Gamage in Tempe, you got to be kidding me, because the music is wild. There's 20-some instruments on the record. It's very weird, very avant-garde, but super cool too.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about another song on the list. And just before that, number 3 on the list is Summertime by the Pistoleros. This is an Arizona band a lot of people have heard of. They were a big deal for a while there early on in the aughts. Why this song, first of all?
You know, that's a great question. Of course, everybody does know about the Pistoleros and their amazing records, their history in the Valley. And it just sort of seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but it was sort of a perception that there was always kind of a dark side to anybody talking about them or writing about them, because of course the tragedy when we lost Lawrence and the brothers sort of were hot and cold with their relationship. I didn't want to go into that so much. I think it's been chronicled very well. So it was a deliberate effort to kind of take a positive spin. And this song just absolutely fit the bill. Had kind of reunited. Their vibes were all great. They were obviously making great music. And I think Summertime just captured that part of the Pistoleros that, hey, let's remember, they were a lot of fun, really talented. We don't always have to think about some of the harder times that they had.
Yeah, that's a nice way to look at it. I'm going to skip way down on the list because there's a song you wanted to talk about in the blues genre called Out on the Road by Jimmy Rogers. Tell us about this one.
I mean, We put in the article, anyone who's a blues fan, and I certainly am, we owe so much to Bob Corritore. He not only just owning the Rhythm Room and bringing so many bands to town, he's told me that when bands come in to play the Rhythm Room while they're in town, he makes sure to book some recording time. I mean, we're talking legendary blues musicians, and he has such a vast catalog, Bob does, of these artists that have come through town. And at one point, I think it was the early 90s, Jimmy Rogers came through, and just what can you say about him? He's he wrote and recorded for Chess Records in the 50s, and he was there throughout. The fact that Jimmy Rogers was here in town is great enough, but Bob brought him into a studio, and they cut the song Out on the Road, which Jimmy had written and recorded himself in 1952 for Chess Records.
When my first wife quit me, boy, she put me out on the road. Now you know I didn't have no home. Boy, I didn't have no place to go.
And it was part of the album that Bob called All-Star Blues Sessions. And there was a song when Bo Diddley was in town.
Wow.
And Pine Top Perkins. And it is a stunning collection of some of the most legendary blues artists who have come through town. And Jimmy Rogers, the fact that they re-recorded his old song from Chess Records, I think was just a great selection.
Yeah, and recorded right here with our own KJZZ's own Bob Quartor, I should say.
Definitely.
All right, well, we have to talk about the number one song on the list, obviously, since it is number one. This is Rebel Rouser from Duane Eddy. Tell us how you chose this. Why number one for this one?
You know, I think we kind of were working with that as number one from the beginning. Mm. It just captures Phoenix. It was so influential to rock and roll. It was way bigger than just, wow, this is recorded in Phoenix. It influenced all the guys from the British Invasion. So it really had a huge impact. I couldn't imagine what could be more of a number one hit than that, mm-hmm. in terms of its Arizona beginnings, and it was recorded here and how far it reached. And I told our editor, Patrick O'Grady, early on, I said, this has got to be number one. Someone's going to have to drive a stake through my heart for this to not be number one. But we were open-minded enough to think, well, maybe there's some other interesting backstory that might maybe bump it out, but we just didn't think anything could. It was just a perfect Arizona song.
Yeah. So let me ask you about that, because a common thread in all of this is, I mean, the requirement that it's recorded in Arizona, not necessarily Arizona artists, but recorded here. What did you notice when you were compiling this about some of these songs? Like, was there something about the recording process here or some of these that were written here and about Arizona that felt very of this place?
You know, that's a great question. I think it's easy to sort of get stuck in Phoenix because of the size of it.
Yeah.
But throughout, the whole state is represented, and there are songs, well, like from Flagstaff, as far south as Bisbee, that are also great. And we didn't want it to be a Phoenix list, that's for sure. There's a lot of Tucson representation because of the amazing talent in Tucson, but really all over the state. What does our list span? 68 years, I think. People have always been making super interesting, super creative, super cool music that each of them had a backstory. And so I was really impressed by just the diversity throughout the whole state. It's by no means just a Phoenix list.
All right, we will leave it there. That is Steve Stockmar, the entertainment editor for the Daily Independent, joining us to talk about their list of the 100 greatest songs recorded here in Arizona. Steve, thank you for coming on. Thanks for sharing this with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Always happy to talk about Arizona music.
All right, that is it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. Radioheads is the name. We are happy to bring it to you every single week on the website. You can sign up, theshow.kjzz.org.
And the show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.